Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will speak with an expert about what proposed changes to SNAP and Medicaid mean for Central Ohio. Jay will also have a conversation about military spousal support. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
We call Columbus Boomtown for a reason. It's growing, not just in terms of business and industry, but also in terms of geography and population. In the next 10 years, the population is estimated to double, if not triple. That stretches social services even further beyond the brink they are already facing. Hunger is becoming a real problem in Central Ohio. New proposed budget and programming cuts for SNAP and Medicaid may make that problem even worse. Vince Hall is the Chief Government Relations Officer at Feeding America and joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Jay. Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Vince, what are the proposed cuts to SNAP, Medicaid, and Medicare?
Well, Jay, the House of Representatives passed a bill, which is now before the U.S. Senate, that would enact very steep cuts to the SNAP program. Now, that's America's foremost defense against hunger in communities nationwide. The SNAP program provides 9 meals for every 1 meal provided by all the nation's food banks combined. So even a small reduction in the SNAP program has major consequences for the local food bank's ability to keep everybody nourished. This bill actually proposes to cut 9.5 billion meals from the SNAP program over the next 10 years, 9.5 billion per year over the next 10 years. And for some comparison, the whole Feeding America network, I mean, most of the food banks in the country combined produced 6 billion meals last year. So the cut is more than 50% larger than the total productivity of the nation's food banks. And we are extremely concerned about the impact that this is going to have on the health of seniors and veterans and children and people with disabilities. But then you add to that these cuts to Medicaid and Medicare, which are also very severe in their own right and have the potential to close hospitals and community clinics, to have people pay a lot more out of pocket for health care and have less money for food. If this House bill were to go through, it would cause 780,000 more people in the country to be food insecure, according to one study. So the combination of cuts to Medicaid, Medicare, and these extremely deep, devastating cuts to SNAP should be of great concern to all of us.
Our sister station, WBNS TV 10 in Columbus, interviewed Senator Bernie Moreno of Ohio, and the Republican senator said that most of this is related to getting people who have no business being in these programs off the programs. He asserts that there's fraud and abuse. How do you respond to that?
Well, with great respect for the senator, getting rid of fraud and abuse, it requires actual investment in the work of finding the fraud and abuse and then taking steps to eliminate it, cutting the benefits for active duty military families, cutting the benefits for veterans and for seniors and for children and for people with disabilities does not solve waste, fraud, and abuse. To give you an example, one of the biggest frauds in the SNAP program, which is actually one of the most fraud-free, one of the least fraudulent programs, is SNAP skimming, where crooks, not the participants in the program, but criminals are putting fake card readers in stores in front of the real card readers, stealing the identity information from those cards and using it to drain the cash from those cards before families have the opportunity to buy enough food for the month. So we should be investing in new technology to strengthen the security of SNAP cards to make sure that the benefits get to the people that Congress intends them to get to. But that requires more money on the front end to fix the technology systems and keep the crooks away from SNAP benefits and put the crooks in jail. And that will save taxpayers more money over the long term. But just indiscriminately cutting benefits for everybody does not equate to dealing with waste, fraud, and abuse. That requires leadership, management, and good criminal prosecution of people who are stealing SNAP benefits.
If these programs are reduced and or eliminated in any way, shape, or form, what group's going to take it on the chin the hardest?
Well, it's a great question, Jay, because ultimately, you know, we want a thriving economy that works for everybody. We want everybody to have pathways to work and be able to feed themselves and their families. Where people have low wage jobs or have disabilities or seniors in their golden years, they do rely on these federal nutrition programs. But anything that is not addressed in terms of people's monthly needs through their own earnings or through the assistance of these nutrition programs, the food banks are the last line of help. Whether it's the church pantries or it's the local nonprofit or the local senior center, there are, you know, 12 Feeding America food banks across the state of Ohio. They partner with 3,600 faith-based organizations and charities to help the 1.4 million people in Ohio who are food insecure. They are the last rung of the ladder in terms of providing help to people. And look, we want children to come to school fit, nourished, and ready to learn. We want seniors to have dignity and grace in their golden years. We want to respect our active duty military families who rely on SNAP to help close their monthly budget equation. And so we need to not leave the burden to food banks, who are already stretched to the breaking point, asked to serve more people with fewer resources than ever before, to absorb yet another massive increase in demand from families and local communities.
I'm going to ask a common sense question that I already know the answer to, but apparently a lot of people don't. If you starve people, and I know that's the extreme, your healthcare costs are going to go up anyway. So what's the point?
Well, that is exactly true. And on average, people who are struggling with food insecurity, meaning they lack consistent access to nutritious food, typically have healthcare costs that are $2,000 or more per year higher than other people. We can't expect people who are suffering from trauma or disease or illness to recover just based on medicines and surgeries. I mean, people have to have access to healthy, nutritious food. It's the fundamental building block of human health. It's the medicine that we all take three times a day. And by providing people with that access to healthy, nutritious food, nothing but good things comes out of it. But you're absolutely right, Jay, that if we want a healthier America, if we want people to thrive in their workplaces and kids to thrive in school, we need to make sure that they begin and end the day with adequate nutrition. Otherwise, our healthcare costs go up. Absenteeism in workplaces and sick days goes, impacted by that. It's vitally important that we invest in good nutrition if we want to have good health and a productive economy.
These programs that exist now, SNAP, Medicaid, Medicare, are perhaps the line of last defense for millions of people. Here's the trillion-dollar question. What are these people supposed to do?
That's a difficult question to answer, Jay. People are, there's a mythology that people on SNAP are able to go out and find the employment that they need to replace those SNAP dollars with wages. The truth is that the majority of the people on the SNAP program are seniors, children, people with disabilities, people whom you can't reasonably expect to enter the workforce and have a pathway to self-sustenance. The good news for taxpayers is that the vast majority of the people on the SNAP program who are able to work are working. SNAP is a major part of helping working families to close their monthly budget gap. And so somebody with two full-time jobs often still finds themselves eligible for SNAP benefits because their wages are so low. And so the myth that SNAP means we're helping unemployed people is a dangerous myth, because it takes hardworking people, the hardest working people I've met in my life, and basically takes away from them the SNAP benefits that are absolutely critical for them to close their monthly budget equation. I mean, in Ohio, 15% of households are struggling with food insecurity. Over 20% of Ohio children are struggling with food insecurity. And so a bill like this, bill that's being considered in Congress right now through the so-called budget reconciliation process, puts those kids at risk. It puts those families at risk. It also puts over 10,000 retailers in Ohio whose economic vitality is stimulated by those SNAP dollars. There's over $1.50 in economic stimulus that comes from every $1 in the benefits. And so there's a larger economic reverberation here that Congress is not really talking about. So we have to raise our voices and change the narrative and speak to the real problems in our communities. And that means no cuts to SNAP, Medicaid, Medicare. We should be strengthening those programs and in the process, strengthening our communities.
Not everyone is empathetic or sympathetic to this issue, but for those who are, what is the best way for them to take action and help?
Well, literally today is a great day to take that action. People need to contact their two U.S. senators. They need to contact their member of the House of Representatives. And they need to say, you know, this is not good for our community. It's not good for Ohio. We need to have you reject these cuts to SNAP, Medicaid, and Medicare. And if people want to do that in a really quick and easy way, I mean, literally it takes less than a minute, they can go to feedingamerica.org/takeaction. Feedingamerica.org/takeaction will give people an immediate access point to the resources that they need to notify their members of Congress that they oppose these cuts. But any way people want to do it, if they can reach out to their senators and their House members, this is the day to do it.
Vince Hall is the Chief Government Relations Officer at Feeding America. We thank you for joining us this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Over 15,000 military-connected youth live in Ohio. In Columbus, the Defense Supply Center employs more than 7,200. Spouses and partners are vital to U.S. military families, providing essential support that helps service members succeed. Yet their role is often sadly overlooked. Frequent moves, limited access to resources, and underemployment can significantly impact their well-being, financial livelihoods, and mental health. Philip Morris USA works with community, academic, and philanthropic partners to support military spouses, including referrals to spouse-focused career supports, training, and education. The annual Blue Star Families Military Family Lifestyle Survey highlights the top concerns for these military spouses. Joining us this morning on Columbus Perspective is J.B. Simcoe, Chief Civil Society and Underage Prevention Officer for Philip Morris. My goodness, what a title, JB.
It is a bit of an unconventional title, Jay, but I am ultimately responsible for our corporate giving, and veterans support is one of the key pillars that we focus on at Philip Morris International.
Well, thank you for clarifying. What are the most pressing issues facing these military spouses today? And for those that are listening, it's not just female spouses. It could be male trailing spouses, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. The support of military families is not gender specific. You have active military, both men and women, and you have people at home taking care of the kids, managing the moves. And so that's really what we started to look at. We recognized this as an area that we wanted to become involved with and explore more. There's not a lot of research, and so we did some research, and then we started listening to the veterans themselves and veteran spouses and their stories, and we released our findings in a publication called On the Home Front, which we just released this week. And the top issue that we understood was consistently a challenge was employment. And that's largely due to the frequent moves that happen, but employment leads to financial stability for these homes and support of the families. And so that was the key issue.
Now, there are two divergent paths that military families can take. One is to live on base, depending upon their assignment, and the other is to live off base. Did the results of this survey find a difference between those two circumstances, or were they the same regardless?
They're generally the same. Obviously, if you're on base, there's a bit more structure and support, and particularly community networks and friends are probably easier. But most of these families are living in civilian, residential areas. So living with you and me, living real life issues, but having to handle those issues, finding doctors, finding schools, finding new homes, making new friends and community every 2.5 years on average. So it is a real challenge, but we didn't see anything specifically different between on post or off post. We just recognize that these are the backbone of these families and they could use some support.
Are there some consistent employers for military spouses that perhaps trend geographic boundaries, or on a case-by-case basis, is it based on what happens in the individual city in which they're located?
Well, you're hitting on a key point, Jay, which is the transportability of work and jobs. And so oftentimes the families themselves go into careers that are transportable. So in terms of teachers and education, in terms of healthcare, those are the types of employers that often provide a great deal of support. But there's more that we as employers can do, recognizing the need for flexibility, the ability now to do remote work more than ever. And so it's important that we raise awareness and that we recognize these issues so that we can create more opportunities for employment for these military spouses. They tend to be a very educated workforce, but underemployed, meaning because of the need for financial stability, they're taking whatever job they can as soon as they can when they enter the community, but they tend to earn about 25% less than civilian counterparts with similar education.
So someone with a bachelor's or a master's may end up taking a job at Target or Walmart just because they want to have some additional income to support the family, and knowing that Target or Walmart could allow them to transfer to any location in the United States, but sadly not pay them what they're worth. That's what we're on?
Sure. They're just not able to find the career path, whatever that may be. Now, obviously, those are jobs that do offer great transportability and are good employers. But certainly, if you studied to be an accountant or, some other area, those are tougher to come by. And because of the frequent moves, employers will see frequent jumps and different jobs, and so it becomes more challenging to obtain those jobs, and that's where we try to plug in. Obviously, we're providing support to do the research. We support a number of local organizations that can help with resume building, job training, mentorship, so that you can find those jobs that better match their skill set and what their education supports.
These are not easy challenges. And beyond the resume writing and the social support, what programs are addressing the problems that exist now?
Well, there are a number of organizations at the local level providing one-to-one support. It can be in the employment area specifically. Another specific area is childcare. Childcare is really what enables spouses to do full-time work unless there's flexibility or remote work opportunities. But we have a number of organizations that you can find locally that will be such as Hire Heroes. We work with the Bob Woodruff Foundation, which also has, it's got your six network partners in all 50 states. So there are a number of ways to get involved and provide that type of practical support. But first and foremost, I think it's just important to recognize the need and to listen and provide support where it's needed at an individual level.
Has the government ever considered some kind of reward for a company or a group of companies that provide the solutions that they might need to address the issues of these military families, or is it left up to the individual community to do that?
Well, I think they're meant to work in tandem. I think these programs and what we try to do, obviously the government provides incredible support to these military families, and it's hard moving so many families so regularly. And so it is upon the communities to work together, finding ways to provide this type of support. And ultimately, that's what we're trying to do. We're investing in the communities where we live and work, where our employees are present and can be a part of the community. And ultimately, we know strong families lead to stronger communities and ultimately strong military in the case of military spouses.
So if I'm listening to this segment on the radio and I'm asking myself the question, what can I, as an individual, do to get involved and to help this issue? What would you say?
Well, I would say join us. I think this is a great opportunity. There's a great need. And so I would first go to the Bob Woodruff Foundation, which is one of our strong national partners, has the Got Your Six Network. And as I mentioned, they're present in all 50 states, and they will have local organizations and volunteer opportunities that you can find locally. On a corporate level or company level, we look to try to create jobs that can be more flexible, remote work, recognizing there may be a need or a population of military spouses in the communities where we are, where we can provide help, or just by listening and being a mentor. I think that oftentimes gets overlooked. But if you, at a very most practical level, are present and listening to the needs and can be a mentor to help military spouses navigate, for example, childcare and employment, that community is so important.
How long has this been a focus for Philip Morris?
Well, we've been a longtime supporter of veterans, but since 2022, we really started to dig in at the local level. And that's where, in 2023, we contributed approximately $3 million to different veterans causes, both at the national level and in the communities where we live and work. And, we're looking to develop sustained partnerships. We have partnered for this white paper with the University of Texas at Austin and Dr. Elisa Bora at the Veterans Spouse Network, where they're doing research and programming. And so we're in this for the long term, Jay.
Well, we want to thank J.B. Simcoe from Philip Morris for joining us to talk about this issue involving military spouses, underemployment, and family stability. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
On July 29th of last year, Columbus City Council approved the first update of the city's zoning code in 70 years. It's called the Zone In Initiative. City leaders say that move sets Columbus up to be able to build more housing to meet the demand and lower housing costs. They say the Columbus region needs more than 200,000 new housing units over the next decade just to keep up with the anticipated growth. And density is an important part of accommodating that growth. The whole idea of Zone In is to expand housing, promote mixed use development, and create neighborhoods where it's easier to walk places and have easier access to public transit. Now, another Columbus neighborhood could soon be transformed under the Zone In initiative. Columbus City Council voted to update zoning regulations along the State Route 161 East Dublin-Granville Road corridor in the Northland neighborhood. We looked into what that rezoning means for the area.
Jack Trott has lived in the Northland neighborhood for 45 years.
A lot of nice people, relatives, a lot of friends in the area.
He remembers when this stretch of State Route 161, Dublin-Granville Road in North Columbus, had more choices.
It used to be called Restaurant Row. It used to have 20 really nice restaurants. Now they're all gone.
What would you like to see?
I'd like to see more restaurants, at least 10 restaurants.
It's pretty incredible when you have residents within an area say, bring this change to me.
Columbus City Council President Pro Tem Rob Doran says the city's plan to update zoning regulations for 160 parcels in Northland could be the trigger to transform the area over time.
The type of change that we're expecting and hoping to see will be measured in years, not in days, weeks, or months.
The Northland rezoning is part of the Zone In initiative to update the city's 70-year-old zoning code. The plan is to create more housing to meet the growing need and more walkable neighborhoods with easier access to public transit.
Our new zoning code takes a different approach, a much more modern approach where residential and commercial can actually coexist together.
Rezoning the parcels on 161 to mixed use will allow developers to build up. Taller buildings could have retail and restaurants on ground level and apartments above.
We're not talking about anything crazy. We're talking about being able to have 4 or 5 or 6 stories in some of these areas, which really matters when we talk about building additional housing in Columbus.
Pat Hamill with the Northland Community Council says the council and other local organizations asked the city to include Northland in the Zone In program.
Over the next 10 to 20 years, the opportunities that it is going to provide, both for people who are already here and people who are coming here, is very exciting to think about.
Jack Trott is cautiously optimistic the rezoning will bring back at least some of the good old days.
Maybe down the road.
Yeah, maybe. Probably not in my lifetime, but maybe in yours.
The city says it incorporated feedback it received from hundreds of people over a 60-day public comment period on the measure to rezone Northland. Joining me now to talk more about Northland and the overall Zone In initiative is Columbus City Council President Pro Tem Rob Dorans. Council member, thanks for being here today.
Yeah, appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
So why did Northland fit into the Zone In initiative?
I think the original first phase of the Zone Initiative from last year really focuses on key corridors throughout Columbus. These were corridors that had good access to public transit at that time, but also would see increased access to transit now, given that the Link Us initiative has passed by the voters, that will increase code of service in some areas by 50%. And really, this area we felt like got left out. From the first update. And frankly, this is really a credit to the neighborhood leaders coming to us and saying, we feel like our neighborhood fits exactly what you're talking about to have this more modernized approach to land use. And that's ultimately why this update came to fruition, was really neighborhood leaders coming to council saying, we want in on this change sooner than later.
You heard Mr. Trott say, I want more restaurants. Is that a possibility?
You know, absolutely. And I think one of the things you see right now in some older areas of the city that have older, you know, historical land use patterns, you have commercial on one area and you have got residential in another. I think the more modern approach that we're taking with this update is to allow mixed use development, right? And when you talk about, that gentleman talking about, hey, there used to be more businesses and more restaurants. Well, you need residents. You need people in a community to be able to patronize those businesses. And bringing additional housing opportunities to those areas should allow more business opportunities. Opportunities like more restaurants or more kinds of things actually to be developed within those areas.
That area is not real easy to get around or to cross over the streets. It's 4 lanes. It's pretty busy. Is the city coordinating to update roadways in these neighborhoods that are in the Zone In initiative?
We are. And I think one of the other key aspects is that the city a couple years ago adopted a new, what's called a thoroughfare plan, which is really our guiding document of how we actually approach road construction in our city that actually wants to help to slow people down a little bit, make things a little safer for everybody, but also really think about how do we drive investment to these areas that are actually now poised for that. So we're actually taking a little bit of a different approach when we actually look at our capital budget at the city. That's the budget that builds physical things like roads, sidewalks, that kind of stuff, and really trying to match those investments with areas of the city that we know have had growth, but with these zoning changes may see additional growth down the line. And that's really a new approach to saying, hey, let's really focus on areas that are poised for this kind of redevelopment in the future.
And you said in the interview with me the other day that this is going to take time. What is the timeline for this? And so far, now that it's been approved almost a year ago, are things moving forward?
Yeah, again, we're measuring this in years, right? Not days, weeks, or months, or anything along those lines. I think when you talk about putting into appropriate land use, then the marketplace has to respond. And there's other variables. We are seeing right now building slow down in parts of the city and certainly across the country. We see things like tariffs from the Trump administration affecting building materials. When you see interest rates not coming down as much as folks thought they would, that all has an impact on whether or not construction happens, whether or not development projects occur. But we are seeing on the parcels that we rezoned last year additional activity. And I think you can look at a couple large-scale projects. You know, one, most prominently, the Lane and High project, where you saw a 16-story tower proposed, a project that under the previous zoning had died a couple times on the vine and now is actually moving forward.
Was it because it was too tall? Or
That had been one of the reasons why that project had not moved forward before. But now with a change in the zoning code, they can go up to 16 stories by right, assuming that they put in the affordable housing requirements that we included within this.
You know, speaking of affordable housing, I mean, that is a big part of the idea here, but could this lead to gentrification and you know, possibly force people out because it might raise property values?
Well, one of the biggest drivers of property values is actually the housing crisis right now. You know, this is not more complicated than the supply and demand issue. We have a lot of demand for housing in Columbus, and we don't have enough supply, which makes everything more valuable. And once you increase that, how valuable that property is, that ultimately raises someone's property taxes. Yeah. So actually in getting more housing in the market should actually help to reduce that jump in property values that folks have experienced for the last 5+ years. So, you know, certainly there's always concern when we talk about things changing in Columbus, what that's going to mean for legacy residents. And there's different, you know, tools in the toolbox towards addressing some of those issues. But fundamentally, bringing more housing online should actually help to stabilize those property tax increases long term.
Now, the Northland area was added into the phase one of the zone in initiative. Is there a zone? Is there a phase two?
Yeah, in the coming weeks, we're going to have a resolution at council that will start off the phase two process. And that's going to take, a larger look at the city. You know, the original first phase of zone in looked at only about 4 or 5% of the city on those key corridors where we wanted to drive some of that high density growth. This next phase is likely to be a lot bigger. It's going to be a lot more across Columbus. It's still going to have a central focus on housing. But also, it's likely to look at things like commercial and industrial zoning. As I mentioned, we had a very, you know, kind of, hey, these uses are over here, residential or commercial, and they shall never come, you know, close to these other kinds of uses. You know, that's not really practical in 2025 and moving in the future. You can look at a lot of big box stores, right, that were built 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. They were built with a sea of parking. Well, we don't shop the same way that we used to. Do we need all that kind of parking? Could those seas of asphalt actually be put to better use, housing or other commercial activity? So it's going to have still a key focus on housing, how we build more housing in Columbus, but also how do we think about our commercial and industrial sites across the city that ultimately like, need to be redeveloped in some manners so that, again, we continue to have the kind of job opportunities for folks in Columbus that we need to make sure that our residents have the ability to economically have stability for them and their families.
And we'll see how this all plays out over the next years. As you say, the timeline is a long one on this. While you're here, I want to ask you about federal funding cuts and policy changes and how they might be impacting the people of Columbus right now. We're hearing about cuts to the arts, you know, food banks, legal aid, public health. What are you seeing in terms of how some of those federal changes are affecting the city?
Yeah, it's a pretty tough situation right now in Columbus, and we're not unique. I mean, there's a lot of communities across the country that are, experiencing similar issues as these radical changes have happened in Washington, D.C. Our auditor is looking at about $200 million or more of an annual basis that are federal funds that are passed down to the city of Columbus. These are everything from dollars to help make sure that we've got folks at Columbus Public Health to make sure that kids get their vaccinations, all the way to literally federal funding to make sure that we're filling potholes, right? And there's a lot of uncertainty right now about sort of different rules and restrictions and, frankly, how those dollars are going to continue to flow. And for a city that has a little over $1 billion annual operating budget, $200 million is not chunk change. So we're really trying to navigate, these waters carefully to figure out how do we make sure that we're taking care of our residents and also adjust to this, very new environment that has provided a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, how does the city do that? I mean, I guess that's what's in the works right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're trying to monitor the situation that's coming out of Washington, D.C. I mean, uncertainty is, I think, the key term here, because a lot of the folks that are making some of these decisions in Washington, I don't think fully understand what the impacts of those decisions are. So one day we may get a communication from a federal agency about this grant, and the next day we may get a communication the next day that says something completely different. So there's a lot of uncertainty right now. But what I can tell you is that we're already feeling that. We had 11 workers at Columbus Public Health that were laid off last month because a federal grant was canceled. We've had nonprofits here in Columbus, as you mentioned. One of the most notable ones, Life Care Alliance, that runs the Meals on Wheels program, have seen cuts through this as well. So it's about seniors not having having access to the food, literally food for them. Mm-hmm. And of course, those agencies are not coming to the city saying, we need your help in order to fill these gaps. And, you know, at a time in which we have a tougher budget than we ever have before because the federal funding has been rolled back, those are really tough decisions. We're trying to figure out how to best move forward.
Councilman Rob Dorans, Council President Pro Tem, I appreciate your time coming in today. I really do.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Have a good rest of your day.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
A changing of the guard times two in the state's Democratic Party leadership. First, a new person is now leading the Ohio Democratic Party. Members of the party's state executive committee voted for Kathleen Clyde to be the new chair of the Ohio Democratic Party. She replaces former party chair Liz Walters, who resigned to become CEO of a political data firm in Washington, D.C. In a statement, Clyde blasted Republican leadership and says she's looking forward to getting to work. She said, in part, with every statewide office and a U.S. Senate race on the ballot, Ohio has key opportunities to elect Democrats who actually work for Ohioans and get our state back on the right track. Also, Ohio House Minority Leader Allison Russo of Upper Arlington announced she will be stepping down from that leadership position at the end of June. She says she wanted to stay in leadership through the state operating budget negotiations that must be finished by June 30th and then have a smooth transition to a new minority leader. Russo has served as House Minority Leader since January of 2020. She says the role has allowed her to shape Democratic priorities and be an unwavering voice for the needs of Ohio working families. She says any decisions about her political future will come at a later time. I asked her earlier this year on Face the State if she will run for governor. She said she didn't know what's next for her and she was looking at all potential options. Russo talked more about her decision to step down from leadership.
I'm looking forward to shifting my focus to policy work and being back on committees. Some of these pieces of legislation that we talked about today, I actually carried as a freshman and sophomore member of this General Assembly. So doing that work, I'm excited about going back to it and thinking about what is next for me after the General Assembly.
Russo says she will not make any endorsements for who should replace her as minority leader, adding that decision is up to the entire House Democratic Caucus. Russo cannot run for re-election to the Ohio House because of term limits. In other news now on the federal level, 17 people got this email that says, quote, per the June 9th, 2025 directive from the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, this email serves as a formal notice of your immediate termination as a member of the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. We appreciate your prior service and commitment. End of email. President Trump announced he plans to replace the Committee for Vaccine Recommendations with his own picks. 10TV exclusively got a copy of that email from Columbus Health Commissioner Dr. Mashika Roberts. She was supposed to start on that committee next month. 10TV's Tracy Townsend sat down with her to talk about getting the news and her reaction to claims of conflict of interest.
First, tell me your immediate reaction to that.
Well, I wasn't surprised. I mean, I've been reading the news stories about it, and this was a committee that I was appointed on at the end of 2024. Mm-hmm. My term was scheduled to start July of this year. And so with the new administration coming in, I was always a little pessimistic about what would really happen. And so I can't say I'm really surprised, mm-hmm. but I'm definitely disappointed and I'm concerned mm-hmm. about the guidance that we'll get from a public health perspective on immunizations moving forward with this administration.
And before we talk about that, because of course that's critical, I want to unpack some of the comments that we heard from the secretary that some of the people on this committee had conflict of interest. As somebody who was named to that committee, what is your reaction to that? Do you have a conflict of interest?
No, I do not. And I think we went... I had to fill out multiple forms to say what conflicts I would have. And so if they did have conflicts, they had to disclose them. I feel that the committee was a diverse group of healthcare professionals who were be able to put their conflicts aside to make the best decisions for the United States public.
And so let's talk about the impact, because there are public health experts like yourself on this who can talk about the importance of vaccines. And this comes at a time when we're seeing pertussis on the rise in Kentucky. Mm-hmm. We just got through the measles outbreak here in our state. Mm-hmm. What is the impact? Our kids in the summer, we're trying to get them in to get their vaccinations mm-hmm. for the next school year.
So the ACIP is a body of individuals, professionals, as you mentioned, who get guidance from the CDC. They get all of the information from the vaccine manufacturers, and they review it. So it's an independent body that is able to do a second look at this data. And then based on the recommendations, the voting of that committee, they decide what is the vaccine recommendation. And I really want to emphasize, it's a recommendation. Whatever the ACIP recommends, just like CDC, is not a mandate. Individuals always have the decision to make, to get those vaccines for themselves and their family members. But based on the ACIP recommendations, that's what our insurance companies decide that they're going to cover. So if the ACIP does not authorize it, insurance companies don't have to cover the cost of that.
Tracy and Dr. Roberts also talked about her previous experience working for the CDC and how recommendations work. You can find that full interview on 10TV.com. The committee's next meeting is scheduled for June 25th through the 27th. It's unclear what will happen next.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.